Hay en la noche un grito y se escucha lejano. Cuentan al sur, es la voz del silencio. En este armario hay un gato encerrado. Porque una mujer.
To fix America's immigrant problem, the U.S. government removed 1 million Mexican immigrants, more than half of whom were U.S. citizens. Orphans, the sick, the unemployed, and others, especially women and children, were rounded up and given train tickets to take them to Mexico. This process has been called the Great Banishment, a Mexican repatriation program during the Great Depression. I'm Emily Auerbach. My guest is Marla Ramirez, professor of history at the UW-Madison, who specializes in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, oral history, and the effect of race, class, and gender on the narrative of Mexican-American history. Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I felt as I was reading your articles about banished women and about this whole period of history, I felt what I often feel, that I've been robbed of part of history. You know, this is a story that doesn't make it into the history books for the most part. And I knew nothing about this period of the Great Depression when, you know, massive deportations took place. Can you, and you've written also in your articles about your own background and your passion for this subject, can you start by talking a little bit about yourself and then what has driven you to this area of research here at UW-Madison?
Yes, thank you, Emily, for inviting me, first and foremost. But, yeah, so you're not alone in the feeling that you don't know much of this history. It was a new history for me, too, when I was an undergrad, that I came to learn about the history of repatriation. Most of my students in every place that I taught in California, but also in Illinois and here in Wisconsin, often come to me after class or during the semester or at the end of the semester to share that they are taken aback but because they had never learned about these histories, about removal, exclusion, even the removal of U.S. citizens that I refer to as banishment. And that is not to say that I'm the one doing this work, because I'm standing in the shoulders of giants, right? There's mm-hmm. historians like Francisco Valderrama and Raymond Rodriguez, who wrote a book, Decade of Betrayal, on this history. There's Mexican scholars, Carrera de Velasco and Enciso. There's a lay professor here in the Department of History who also wrote a book about the history of repatriation focusing on labor. So I'm building on this historiography, but it's still a very young field in history, right? That there's still a lot of work and to be done to bring this history to the general public, but also K-12, because it's only taught in very specialized courses in college. If mm-hmm. you take a class about the history of the U.S.-Mexico borderlands, then you get an opportunity to learn about this history, or a history class or ethnic studies class about immigration, then you get most likely get to learn about this history. Or a professor who's teaching an intro to U.S. history class who is well-versed in this subfields of history, then you'll get a snippet of this history. But otherwise, you don't learn it, especially not in K-12. But that is slowly changing, too, right? That now there's different legislations in California, and other states have proposed similar legislations, including Michigan, to revise the K-12 curriculum to teach its histories. And it is a movement that began from the ground up, right? It was elementary school students, fifth graders, who went to the Senate in California and said, our teacher taught us about this history. How come nobody else is learning about mm-hmm. this history? We want this in the curriculum. And they wrote letters to their representatives. And that's how that history now is being taught in California, because the curriculum was revised to include this history. But it, as you as you know well, change happens very slowly.
It happens slowly. I was glad to see that there was an apology, an official apology in the state of California, and there's now a plaque. We'll talk about that later, where some of the deportation raids took place. But so this subject, you said, has been worked on. You're standing on the shoulder of giants, but it's also a fairly young field, too, and not really something that everyone knows about. Can you also share your own story and how that gives you the capacity as an oral historian to make links that might otherwise not be made?
Definitely. Yes. So I was born in Michoacán, Mexico. I came to the United States when I was 13 years old, 12, about to be 13. And my parents obviously immigrated with me. So I came with my father immigrated first in 1995. And then my mother, four sisters, and I came in 1996 to reunite with my father. So I'm a product of immigration, right? I'm a product of displacement, economic displacement, that pushed my parents to make a decision to leave their families, their home, everything they knew. I often remind students that immigrants don't simply wake up one day and say, I want to leave everything and go to a different country. It is a displacement force. It's a very hard decision for families to leave everything behind and start anew in a new place that is completely unknown to them. So my parents made that sacrifice thinking about their five daughters, right? And before we came on air, I was sharing that both of my parents only have an elementary school education. So they were thinking not only about the limited economic resources and their inability to provide for us in Mexico during the recession in the early 90s, but they were also thinking about the opportunities that a country like the United States could provide for their daughters, right, in terms of education. And even though they only have an elementary school education, they always push for us to continue our education. It's similar to the work that you're doing with Odyssey program, that parents of immigrant communities often see education as a key to open new opportunities. And so that's how I end up becoming a historian, an oral historian, but really the work of oral history for me, that the first lessons of how to be an oral historian for me began at my home with my grandparents and my parents, right? Listening to the stories about migration when we came together and they share stories about how my aunt or my uncle or my grandfather had come to the United States, living that experience myself of coming to the United States with my parents as an immigrant myself, I became really intrigued about what stories I have learned so much about listening to my family's memories and how there was a disconnect between what I heard from family members and my parents and my grandparents and what I was reading in history books about that same history. So I knew there was a disconnect, that something was missing. And it was years later, until I was in grad school, that I learned that oral history was a methodology that I could use to conduct research, right? And I was really fortunate to be trained by late Professor Horacio Roque Ramirez, who was an oral historian, and introduced me to the field of oral history. And I realized, wow, I can use the knowledge embodied in immigrant communities and the knowledges that they have that are missing not only from the books and articles that we're reading in the classroom, but also oftentimes these histories are not archived in institutional archives, because it's oftentimes, and that's also changing, and I talk often about change and how we came to train and archive and collect stories from people that we seem as worthy of knowing, and people in power, for instance, people who have made influence or different sources. But everyday people are also history makers, right? Everyday people hold knowledge and different sorts of knowledge, right, that can inform how we understand, how can we better understand national episodes or larger historical events. And so oral history allows the historian to come to a community and work with them to collect those oral those memories and knowledges in oral form and transcribe them to put them in written version. And then the next step is to donate them to an archive to preserve them for longevity so other scholars can have access to them. So that's really how I came to this topic. And well, how I came to academia, how I came to be an oral historian. And then it was when I was doing my master's, I was interviewing immigrant youth, and I wanted to understand what factors led to some people going to the college route and other people going into the job sector. And so I was conducting oral histories to get to that question. And one of the first questions that I asked in my interviews for that project was, how do you identify yourself? And one of the narrators who I interviewed, Jesus, said, I'm a U.S. citizen, but not legally recognized as one. And automatically I thought, oh, well, they came when they were young, they were raised in the United States. It's cultural citizenship, right? They understand themselves as American, but legally they're undocumented. But then I will hear the voice of my mentor, Horacio Roque Ramirez, who also always say, never assume what you think the person is referring to, right? I always ask a follow-up question. So, and I'm thankful for Horacio for putting that voice in my head, right? That I asked a follow-up question and I said, so what do you mean when you say you're a U.S. citizen? And that question that seemed insignificant at that moment shifted my whole trajectory as a scholar, as an academic in training when I was a grad student, and brought me to this topic. Because Jesus answered, well, my grandmother on my dad's side was born in the United States, but she was kicked out, was a term he used, when she was a child from the United States. And now I'm here and I'm undocumented. And from that question, I simply threw away my interview guide, the questions that I wanted to ask about my project in the master's stage. And I started asking questions about his family history and why, if his grandmother, his paternal grandmother, was a U.S. citizen, how come he was undocumented? Right. And that brought me to this history.
Yeah, and I was fascinated how complicated all the different terms are. We'll talk about that in a bit, whether it's deportation or banishment or repatriation or just what you call certain things is loaded as well. Before we get to what happened during the Great Depression and this, you know, really mass deportation that occurred then, especially of women and children, can we talk a little bit about the history of kicking people out that you, in one of your articles, you go all the way back to the 1600s and how people were kicked out if they were considered rogues, vagabonds, and gypsies, anyone undesirable. You know, we're talking about the first Puritan colony, the, you know, early things where pauper aliens were identified. Can you give us some kind of history of just how old this process is of identifying people as undesirable and kicking them out, and how loaded that is in terms of race and economic status and other things?
Definitely. The way that I situate my book for the history of banished women and banished families is that it is situated around the likely to become public charge clause within the Immigration Act of 1917 that can be traced back to the 1600, but also continue to be implemented in every immigration bill since then. So we have this long history of exclusion of immigrants based on class status. And of course, class status is also attached to gender, because women were economically dependent on men, whether it be their fathers or their husbands. That definition changed slowly in the 1940s and 50s, but until then, women were defined through their economic status of their husbands or fathers. And so I'm tracing this history of class and gender and race, and obviously class, status, and race are also consciously and unconsciously linked together, right, at the immigration ports by immigration officers who have the authority to decide on a case-by-case basis whether to admit a person or deport a person. And so these conscious or unconscious biases come into the regulation of immigration, right? And so it is through class status that exclusion happens. And obviously, when we talk about like the likelihood to become a public charge, in policy terms, it makes sense, right, that we don't want to admit immigrants who are going to become economically dependent on public benefits or going to become a charge to the country. So in political terms, in policy terms, it makes sense to have these limitations. But in practice, it gets really messy, and it gets really messy really fast. Because as I said before, there's intersections of race and gender with class status and how we determine who is worthy of being included into the United States national polity and who is unworthy and has to be excluded. And then there's erasures of U.S. citizenship too, right? That has happened with banished women because they were physically, phenotypically, they appear as immigrants because they were dark-skinned and of Mexican ethnic origin. And so they were read as unwhite and thus not citizens and eligible for removal. But the episode of mass removals because of banishment during the Great Depression, it was also informed during the greatest economic crisis at the time, that the idea was that we needed to remove immigrants who were undocumented because there were very little resources and jobs for U.S. citizens. And again, this entanglement of race and class came together to exclude not only Mexican immigrants, but also U.S. citizens of Mexican descent.
Before we get to the period of the Great Depression, what would you say is important for us to understand about the period of the Mexican-American War and the whole situation where you can have Mexicans living on what might now be California or other areas and the whole changing borders and the sense of, you know, who belongs here and who doesn't? Right. Can you talk a little bit about what we need to know about that period in history as well?
Yeah. We often hear that the United States is a nation of immigrants, but that is a myth too, right? The United States was a nation of native peoples, and then immigrants came to invade this nation, as we know, right? And so there's a white settled colonist who came to the United States, but also borders have been shifted and changed over time because of war and conquest, right? So what is now Mexico was once native nations in Mesoamerica. Then they were later conquered by the Spanish, and they were part of the Spanish crown. And then they were conquered by the United States, and part of Mexico became the United States, right? So it's a longer history of conquest and war and national borders. We think them as very rigid, but they're malleable, right? They change. They are shifted over time. And what it was one nation 100 years ago is a completely different nation today, right? Or even not even a nation anymore, and people become stateless, right? So Mexico, after they gain independence from the Spanish crown, there was the Mexican-American War of 1846 to 1848, where Mexico lost the war, and in the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, the Peace Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo of 1848, the agreement was that to declare peace, the United States or Mexico was going to sell a portion of its territory to Mexico for a mere amount. And almost half of the territory of Mexico became part of the United States, which is today's California, Arizona, Texas, part of Colorado and Utah. And within those territories, about 150,000 Mexicans became part of the United States overnight, right? They woke up one day and they now were in a new side of a new border they were in the United States. And so they had to decide whether to stay in the United States or go back to the new borderline in Mexico. And they were given a year to decide what they wanted to do. If they remain in the United States, on paper, they were entitled to U.S. citizenship and to the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo also promised them that they would have the right to keep their land. And obviously we know that in practice, those things were also muddy, right? And in order to be eligible for citizenship, you had to go to court, to state court. It was before it became a federal regulated law, it was regulated by the states. And so Mexicans in the United States, after annexation, they had to go to a state court and apply for citizenship, but they only had 1 year. So if they missed a deadline, or they didn't speak English or didn't know how the U.S. laws worked, then they became undocumented, right? So that's how undocumentation also happened, right? And people who left and they remain in Mexico, some people were successful in applying for U.S. citizenship, but you had to prove your whiteness. So Mexicans, unlike other racial and ethnic groups in the United States, were classified as white, legally speaking, since 1848, after the peace treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo. And they were classified as white because whiteness was a prerequisite of citizenship. So in order to be...
Because this is still the time of slavery, too.
Yes, yes, exactly. And so Mexicans were classified as white and eligible for citizenship before the laws had changed to open citizenship rights to anybody born in the United States. And so only a small portion of the approximately 150,000 people in the annexed territories were eligible and successfully applied for citizenship. But then a sector of them also became undocumented if they weren't able to navigate the court system. And then immigration continued to happen because of the proximity of the two countries. There has been immigration even before 1848, back and forth, not only Mexicans coming to the United States, but also white Americans going into Mexico, right? As we know today, it's happening too. And so this movement across borders had been unquestioned until that regulation became more strict at the border. And citizenship for Mexicans also is different from other ethnic and racial groups because of annexation and their classification, at least on paper, about their whiteness that later was removed, evidently in the 1930s, when even U.S. citizens were sent out of the United States and banished.
You can see just how complicated it is. We're going to be talking about what happened during the Great Depression that led to U.S. citizens who were deemed somehow not guaranteed those same citizen rights to be banished from this country. More in a moment on University of the Air.
Cuando ya mi mamá nos llevó a que nos vacunara, me acuerdo que yo llevaba aquí la vacuna. Y mi mamá, yo para mí que mi mamá me iba a mandar a la escuela, porque ya íbamos a catecismo.
¿Qué edad tenía?
Cruzábamos donde estaba el tranvía y esperábamos que nos... Yo tenía como 6 años.
¿Ya estaba lista para la escuela, como para primero?
Por sí, y ya iba yo a catecismo con las monjitas.
That is the voice of Ramona Espinoza, who was banished in 1932. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with my guest, Professor Marla Ramirez, and we are talking about a missed period of American history when Mexican citizens and others were banished from the country during the Great Depression. Well, Marla, I took French, German, and Old English as part of my PhD program, but not Spanish, unfortunately. Can you translate a little bit of what we were just hearing?
Yeah, what the voice that we heard is that of Ramona Espinosa, as you mentioned, who unfortunately passed away recently. And she is, when I interviewed her a few years back, she was narrating her experience of removal during 1932. So she shared that she remembers going into the LA Public Hospital, Los Angeles Public Hospital, to get vaccinated when she was around 6 years of age. And she has vivid memories of going to the hospital because she was really excited that she was going to start elementary school. So she even has a mark of the vaccination, and she has her vaccination card and they stamped on one of the last visits that she made to the hospital before her removal. And then she remembers that shortly after her mother received a letter, and she is explaining that the letter, the quote-unquote repatriation letter, is they had a date on the time that they had to depart the United States, and if they didn't go on the train and follow the guidelines of the letter, then immigration officers oftentimes will come to your home and just take you and remove you without having any time to gather important documents or belongings and planning your trip to Mexico. So Ramona's mother, Felicitas, decided to gather all their belongings, and she said she had 2 big suitcases, and she packed all their lives in the United States into 2 suitcases and boarded the train And so she remembers going on the train, and her father had had an accident days prior to the removal order. And the father escaped the hospital to meet his family at the train station. And she remembers the father coming into the train, and the parents were crying because the father couldn't leave with them. So that meant family separation for them. And the mother that used to unpack his clothing and belongings. And then the father stayed in the United States, and Felicitas, along with Ramona and other three U.S. citizen siblings of hers, boarded the train that took them to Sinaloa, Michoacán, where they spent more than 20 years before, or about 15 years, rather, before Ramona was able to come back to the United States. Felicitas, the mother, attempted numerous times to come back since the moment she arrived to Mexico, and she was unsuccessful because as a single mother of four, again, she was deemed as likely to become public charge. The same class that had removed her from the United States prevented her to come back. And it wasn't until Ramona became old enough and started asking questions about her citizenship, and her mother had a copy of her baptismal record that proved her legal status in the United States. And ironically enough, she first came back to the United States as a temporary worker right before the Bracero program. She was recruited to come work in canneries in California and in agriculture to cover or to be able to be part of the wartime labor shortages to help the United States. So the history of banished women is a history of constant displacement. And only temporary inclusion when they are needed. Mm-hmm. And then when economic situations worsen again, once again, they're displaced. So in the 1930s, during the economic crisis, Mexican and Mexican-Americans alike were removed because of the crisis. And then employers went into border towns. And so even though Ramona and her family were banished to Sinaloa, Felicitas and Ramona's family made their way back to the border in their attempt to come back to the United States. But when they were denied entrance, they settled in a colony in Mexicali, which is a border town with the United States. And many people have similar fates in trying to come back. They were denied entry, and so they settled in border towns in hopes of eventually being able to return to the United States. And so employers somehow learn about this settlement in the border towns. And what Felicitas, in her narration of her oral history, concludes is that they will first come to work independently, right? They will come and work in the summers in the United States because it was only minutes away from the border town, the Mexicali town where she lived. The immigration officer, where the checkpoint that she will cross daily to come to work in the United States with her baptismal record, told her and her friends that they would no longer be able to come using the baptismal records. They had to go to the American consulate in Mexicali at the time to register themselves. And so they went and registered. And then Ramona recalls that soon after that, months after that, or maybe the following summer after that, there were employers that would go through her neighborhood seeking workers to work in canneries and agriculture. And she always wondered how they knew they were there, because they only recruited the U.S. citizen minors that mm-hmm. at the time they were teenagers. And now she thinks that because they went to the consulate, the American consulate, and registered themselves to be able to enter with a border crossing card, because of World War One, there was a new regulation that you need to have a border crossing card. That allow employers to have access points to locate their addresses and go knock on their doors to recruit them during World War II to come work in the United States. So she came as a temporary worker, even though she was a U.S. citizen. And it wasn't until later, after she married, that she came and settled permanently back in her native country. So it's a constant history of custom displacement and marginalization across both sides of the U.S.-Mexico border.
Oh, what a heartbreaking story, too, going back to when she was six and got vaccinated and thought she would be starting school I guess I'm curious about the letter that the government sent at that point. It was 1932, basically saying, you've got to leave, and either you can go on this train or you'll be forcibly removed. How did a letter like that state the reason, especially in this case where they were citizens?
Yes.
It's like, dear so-and-so, sorry, but, you know, because of what? How could you justify what that was?
Yeah, that's a great question. The way that the banishments were taking place and the repatriations of Mexican nationals were taking place were, again, based on the likelihood to become a public charge clause, right, of the 1917 Immigration Act. And so if anybody who was of Mexican origin or Mexican descent went to ask for public assistance, then instead of receiving public assistance, they would be placed in removal list in this so-called...
Even if they were citizens?
Actually, the letters were often addressed to the head of the household, usually the male head of household. So if the wife was a citizen and the children were citizens, it did not really matter because the removal letter was for the head of the household. But because the wives and the children were economic dependents of them, they had to follow the father out of the United States. The legality of it is questionable, right?
Right.
But the tactics were not questionable at the time because the removal was for the father, even though...
But then why wasn't he allowed to go on the train? If
yeah.
Was it deemed that his labor was needed?
No, the father was unemployed at the time, and so then the letter came to him. But also, if anybody went to... So let me explain first the father role. So the father was unemployed, and he received he asked for public assistance, or maybe he... somehow he got into the ears of the social workers for the relief roles, right? And so he was enlisted in removal, in the repatriation process, the removal process. And so... He just happened to have an accident days before the date of the train departure. And because he was driving, he was in a car and the cousin was driving and the cousin was under the influence of alcohol. So he had to go to court. So he couldn't leave because he had to go to court. And the daughter later found the court records to see what really happened. Because she's like, I don't know, did he just wanted to stay here? Was it like my mom is imagining that he came to the train? And in fact, she found that records where the cousin was driving and they had to go to court. The father was in charge, but he had to stay here for 6 months or a year for the court case to unfold. And then he never went back. He just stayed here, hoping that the family could come and join him, but they were never able to do so. But other ways that people were removed, too, was, as Ramona is also narrating in that opening audio, is that if you went to a hospital and asked for medical services, but you didn't have a job or a solid income, then you were also labeled as likelihood to become public charge. And in Los Angeles, California, both the Department of Charities and the Department of the LA Public Hospital were both overseen by the same entity. And so people were labeled as likely to become public charge if they asked for public assistance, relief roles, or if they asked for medical assistance.
And they probably didn't know that when they showed up at those places to get food or to get care.
Exactly.
And then that meant that they would be targeted. You also write that one reason that women were targeted, besides that they were seen as dependent on, you know, men in their lives and so on, was they were seen as fertile and, you know, with the potential of giving birth to a lot of babies who would be born as citizens.
Yeah. So at the time in the 1920s and 30s, eugenics was at the rise in the United States. So this idea of reimagining racial hierarchies or restructuring racial hierarchies in the United States with a priority of whiteness, right? That the idea that white race was superior to other ethnic and racial minorities. And because of those ideals and discourses and politics of whiteness, then people of color were seen as undesirable, right? And it's a stereotype, a rhetoric, a politics that continues to be recycled against different ethnic and racial groups, right? It was Mexicans in the 30s, but it was also Filipinos in the 30s, but it was Chinese before that, and Japanese too, right? And Italians before that. So it has been recycled almost identically, almost line by line in the way that we hear these political debates about desirability and worthiness of inclusion against different ethnic and racial groups. But in the 1930s, it was, with the case of mass removals, it was a discourse that was pinned against Mexicans, right? And so Mexican women and Mexican-American women were specifically feared under these political debates and ideas of eugenics because of their power of their reproduction, right? That they had the ability to give birth to children who at the time, because the laws had changed, now we have birthright citizenship, that anybody born within the borders of the United States then automatically became a citizen. And that was a concern for nativists and immigration restrictionists who wanted to keep the United States as a white-only nation. And so women specifically became even more targeted because they have, if they were not already U.S. citizens, or if they were U.S. citizens, they had the power of making the United States less white because of their reproductive power. Or even men, too, intermarrying with white women was also a big concern. And it was also very controlled at the time.
I recently read the novel The Wind Knows My Name by Isabel Allende, where she has a parallel story of a child fleeing Nazi-occupied Austria and then a child at the border right now, you know, with Mexico and the United States. In both stories, there's a lot of scapegoating. Mm-hmm. You know, when people are afraid or when the economic times are troubling, there's this tendency to point fingers and identify a scapegoat group. And to what extent was that the case in the Great Depression, where things are scary, you know, money is suddenly worth little, their jobs are scarce, there's bread lines. Yeah. How do you see xenophobia and scapegoating and so on happening at those times, wherever you are?
Oh, definitely. It was the root, one of the main roots of this historical event, xenophobia. And really, whenever there's a crisis, whether it be economic or otherwise, there fear is at the center, right? And racism and discrimination and xenophobia are informed by fear and ignorance, right? And so at the time, like the Great Depression, where resources are limited, where jobs are limited, where people don't know if they're going to have enough food to eat, if they're going to have a job in a year or in a month or in a week, right? Then xenophobia is easy to take root and to then point the finger and scapegoat a specific group. And it's always easier to say, you're at fault, right? To somebody who is marginalized, to scapegoat them. And Mexicans became the scapegoat at the time in great numbers, right? But they were not the only scapegoat group at the time. Soon after this event in 1935, we have the Filipino Repatriation Act, right? And Filipinos who were nationals of the United States were also removed from the United States. But we had the Chinese exclusion laws mm-hmm. before then, right? And because of different fears of different sources. And in the Great Depression, it was limited resources. And people were just worried that they might not have a job. They might not have enough food for their families. And Mexicans became an easy scapegoat because of the close proximity of the two countries. Mexicans were here in very large numbers, but also because of the annexation of Mexican territory. And also because of the proximity, it was easier to remove Mexicans instead of removing Italians, for instance, or removing Japanese people. Well, they already have the exclusion laws, but removing other groups across an ocean, economically, it didn't make sense. And because we have a very developed train system that interconnected both Mexico and the United States, it became an easy solution to remove Mexicans en masse.
And can we talk just briefly about terminology? Because there's repatriation.
Yes.
There's deportation. There's banishment.
Yes.
You know, these different terms that, and there's being kicked out,
yes,
forcibly removed. There's all these ways that this is referred to.
Yes, and it's not that one term is right and the others are wrong. There's multiple processes happening, right? And we cannot use a blanket term, I argue, to describe all the different experiences of removal because it erases the injustices of removing U.S. citizens, for instance, as my book argues. So there were deportations happening in mass, right? The Hoover administration was very supportive of mass deportations during this time period, during the decade of the 30s, really. Well, during his administration, the first half of the 30s. And so there's deportations happening. And deportations are the removal of undocumented immigrants who are breaking either any number of laws, either being here totally being undocumented, or they broke another immigration law or any other law and then call attention to themselves and then enter deportation proceedings. But deportation has to have a process, right, where the immigrant has the opportunity to go before an immigration judge and be able to appeal their case and have the opportunity to have a fair trial to be able to, if they so desire to stay in the United States, if they can prove that they're eligible to stay in the United States. So that is happening, right? Deportations are happening. But that's not what happened with people that are put in a train because they're asking for public assistance. They were not legally deported under this process where they have to go to court and see an immigration attorney or had the opportunity to even consult an attorney to see if they could legally remain in the United States. So that is one process of removal that was happening.
And that would be banishment, because if it was repatriation, that would be a choice to go.
Right. Right? So deportation in itself is people who are undocumented. So the United States are entitled to open an immigration case and see if they're deportable, right? But also the immigrant is entitled to appeal their case and prove that they can stay. So that's one scenario. The other scenario is what is being defined as repatriation. And repatriation, in essence, has to be voluntary, right? The immigrant here in the United States is asking their government, in this case Mexico, or the U.S. government for assistance because they don't have the means to pay for the transportation, but
so they
want to go back.
Back to the homeland.
To the homeland, right. Mm-hmm. That's the other scenario. And that is happening. Some immigrants, because they have no jobs, because they are denied employment and public assistance, they decide that they want to go to Mexico, right? And if they didn't have the funds, they go to their Mexican consulate or they go to their local governments and ask for help, right? And so that is also happening, right? But then in the case of the U.S. citizen children and women, they're not asking for repatriation assistance. They already are in their homeland. The United States is their home country. They were born here, right? And they cannot be deported because they're not undocumented. So deportation is not a term that applies for them, or they can even legally be deported, right? Repatriation is not a term that can define their experience because it's not voluntary and because their home country is the United States, not Mexico. Mm-hmm. So that's why I use the term banishment.
Banish, yeah.
To refer to the experiences of U.S. citizens who were removed.
We're going to hear about a few more of the banished women and children when we return in a moment with University of the Air.
Yo digo que ahí fue donde me supieron dónde vivíamos, porque mandaban una carta y allí decía cuándo se tenía uno que ir. Cuando la gente se tenía que ir, tenía la fecha. Y es que a qué hora se iba a ir en el tren, nos fuimos en el tren.
That is Guadalupe talking about how her mother was banished and about her interest in family history. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Marla Ramirez, and we've been talking about banished Mexican-American women. I wanted to ask you, first of all, let's talk about Guadalupe. Just give me a little sense of that. But then I do want to ask you about oral history itself, some of the pros and cons of that method of history.
Yeah.
So tell me a little bit more about Guadalupe.
Yeah. So when I came to interview families who generously agreed to work with me in this project, I had already done extensive archival research myself in California, in Mexico, and in Washington, D.C., and the National Archives. And it was a surprise to me to find that almost every family who I interviewed had a self-designated family historian who had taken the lead to find photographs, letters, newspaper clippings, to have an official record of their family history, almost as if they had been heard or they have heard or questioned about the factibility of their families being removed if they were U.S. citizens. And they took it upon themselves to find proof to show that it wasn't a family tale, that it's actually part of U.S. history, that they were actually living in the United States and then removed, even though they were U.S. citizens, right? But Guadalupe Espinosa, whose voice we just heard, when a stepfather, she actually trained herself as a family historian. She went to her local archive in California, Laguna Niguel, and took a training in archival research and went through the different archive sources, collections there, to try to dig out her family's history. And she found a rich archive. She created a rich family archive. She found the court records for her father's case when he was when he had a car accident before the mother and grandmother were banished. She found census records with the address where they lived before the removal. She dig out the vaccination card for Felicitas, her mother, Ramona, her mother. And so she has this rich archive. And then one time when she was in Laguna Niguel in the reading room, going through the different folders and boxes to see what she could find about her family history, she overheard a person who came into the archives and asked the archivist for a certified copy of a family document. And then she then asked the archivist why was that document certified, and the archivist explained that oftentimes people will come into the archives to, or attorneys will come into the archives for their clients to dig out family history to demonstrate that they have presence in the United States and be able to establish an immigration case to remain in the United States if they're in deportation proceedings. And so they can do they can produce an official record that has a stamp and a ribbon that is a legal document, right? It transitions from being an archival document to being a legal document, can be used in court. And so Guadalupe paid all these fees to certify all of the records that she had found for her family's history in the Laguna Niguel archives. And in my conversations with her, it became clear that not only did she wanted to document her family's history on paper, because she had a rich record already orally, because she had heard the stories of her mother's and her memories of removal. And she also had talked a lot with her grandmother and her experience of being removed in the 30s. So she had this family oral history, right, that she had oral traditions that she had her family share with her. But then she went to the archives and documented on paper, and then she certified them. And it is this effort of families who were banished, who were removed, who were erased from U.S. history to reconstruct their existence and their history. And Guadalupe really took it to the next level to make it extra official, to say they had a legal right of mm-hmm. being here. They were U.S. citizens, and yet you insisted in erasing them and removing them.
I can see that would be part of wanting to validate one's claims, to show, look, here are the documents. We all know that memory can be a tricky thing, that sometimes when you're trying to construct a memory you have as a child, you don't know if you're remembering a story you were told experiencing it yourself, seeing a photograph, mm-hmm. having a dream. I mean, memory is fluid, but that's true in a written account, a memoir, as well as in an oral history. You write that, people tend to be sort of more suspicious of oral history, mm-hmm. but that in a way it's no different than some, you know, looking at somebody's written account. That's suspicious too. You can, you know, we all construct a narrative maybe with ourselves at the center as a hero, or we can exaggerate, we can misremember. How do you as an oral historian kind of figure out facts and what counts and
And the job of the historian is to find, to reconstruct the past as accurately as possible, right? And we face different challenges as historians, but oral historians face a different layer of challenges, right? And as you accurately say, memory is fluid and memory is informed by different factors and it changes over time too. So oral historians are not only interested in reconstructing the past and finding the truth about the past, but we're also interested in knowing why people remember the way they remember. So we are fascinated by both the finding the truth of the past, but also understanding what factors led people to believe or understand their past the way they understand it and remember it today. So we do both. We do the oral history interviews, and we have the opportunity to ask people why you remember this the way that you mm-hmm. remember, right? We use photographs, for instance, to trigger their memories. We go, but we also go into the archives and we do archival research to see what we find in the written records there. And then we have the opportunity to use the written records and say, look, this is what I found about this episode of history. Do you know anything about this? Do you remember hearing anything about that, right? And so we use, we put both the written record and the memory of survivors in conversation with each other. And oral history, when it was emerging in the 70s and even in the 90s, it was often questioned a lot, more so than now. It's still questioned, obviously, because of the subjectivity of memory, right? And which is a valid question, right? Because as you say, we remember things different. We think that we remember something, but maybe it's a family story or a photograph.
Well, and siblings will have a completely different account of the same thing.
Definitely. So. And so the way that we understand memory is that it is not always reliable, but it gives an opportunity to capture things that have not been written down. Erase histories, forgotten histories, marginalized histories, right? That even if it's only a glimpse into the past, it gives us an opportunity to dig into that and then find other sources to corroborate. And the way that I also dealt with oral history was exactly what you said now, that because people remember or misremember things, I didn't only interviewed survivors who were banished, but I also interviewed their children and grandchildren, and I did individual oral histories, and then I did family histories to help each other check their memories, but also trigger their memories when they come in a group and do a family group interview. So my methodology is mixed and varied precisely because I wanted to unearth a hidden history and a known history.
And it's such a rich area. One sentence that you wrote really stood out to me, which is that banishment is not merely a story of sorrow and discrimination. Instead, these narrators, the ones giving you the oral history, show you that it is also a history of resistance, family unity, and resilience. That in the pain and the sorrow and the discrimination, you can also find an account of amazing strength and triumph. Marla Ramirez has been my guest. Thank you so much for your work that you're doing and for sharing it with us on University of the Air.
Thank you, Emily. It has been an honor to be in conversation with you today.
I'm Emily Auerbach, hoping you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.